Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brucey.
Shakira.
And we are here to tackle education in America, the great equalizer of false sense of success, and just kind of dibbling and dabbling into how the perception of the academic institution here in America has shifted, and overall, what are some of the sentiments with regard to the value and the appreciation of education. But before we get right into that, I just want to catch up with Shakira and see what's been going on over the past week. Anything new or exciting?
No, not much. I know I'm full steam ahead with Maryland had their elections yesterday, so coming down off of that. Of course, I'm always in somebody's homeless camps or something, but other than that, pretty quiet, just working on things. How about you? How are things going? I know you have a lot going on.
Well, you know, I'm just trying to stay above water. Just working like crazy, pretty much, and just trying to become more of in the know about a little bit more the stuff that's going on. I will tell you, like, over the kind of with this topic, and it kind of bridges the gap into kind of a different topic. I know you're familiar with the infamous Jane Elliott. Or at least have heard of her. I've been just watching like a lot of her videos lately and just kind of looking over a lot of her research, and it's kind of somewhat related to our topic today. And I'll just kind of bring that up, I guess, every now and again or whenever I can, because I think that a lot of what she did, especially in her blue-eye, brown-eye experiment, and basically, for those who don't know about Jane Elliott, she's pretty much a diversity educator, like an activist that kind of speaks about a lot of pretty much discrimination and bigotry and things of the sort. And she started all this, I guess, experimentation, if you will, just research as she was teaching third grade. I believe it was back in the 70s or so. But specifically related to, like, this experiment that she was talking about, the blue eye brown eye experiment, she kind of just basically broke people down based upon their eye color and gave people the ability, or if you will, to experience what it's like to be discriminated upon based upon some sort of characteristic, just as we do in many aspects with regard to race in this country and whatnot. And as far as education goes, one of the things that kind of just came forward to me and just kind of made that light bulb go off is she was speaking of minorities, specifically blacks and Latinos, and how she said in so many words that many minorities aren't pushed. I mean, they're pushed out of academic institutions such as like high school and whatnot as far as dropout goes, because the education isn't relevant, and just the mentality towards their respective people groups. And she gets more into it, but it just kind of really started making me think of do people actually make the decision that they don't want to go forward with their education because of, you know, lack of value for education, or is it they feel that it's not that relevant or pertinent with regard to what they want to do, or so that you just kind of open the can of worms. And I know I'm rambling on, but that'll be something we can tackle in the future if we ever talk about racism or something like that, because she said a lot in just, you know, a 50-minute type of experiment that she did with college students. And I think it kind of ties to what we're going to talk about today in some sort of sense, but it's kind of like more of like a specific point, if you will, with regard to education.
I did. I'm definitely a fan of the exercise, particularly because it was done kind of in response to Martin Luther King's assassination, and also it looked at, you know, the inferior and superior complex that a lot of people don't necessarily talk about. I think she was kind of innovative in her approach to bringing her kind of anti-racism ideology to the forefront. A lot of people weren't necessarily doing that, or they weren't talking about it, and, you know, she did that openly in her exercise, and it has shown not only just in the education system, but more so in the kind of realm of sociology. It definitely is one of those pivotal kind of influences that it had.
I definitely I'm with you there with that, because I mean, there's just so much, and you know, especially being a white female, and I mean, there are always going to be exceptions to the main, you know, idea and whatnot, but just the fact that her main goal was to, like I said, plant that seed and cause people to look at themselves and see how, you know, they can become a part of, well, first of all, so they can see the problem and see what exists and how they themselves, based upon the way they live, can change and sort of kind of combat, if you will, or become a part of the solution.
Yeah. And I think, it, like you said, it definitely relates in regards to education, because when you look at racism, I think it definitely does play its place in the, you know, I look at racism from the construct as an institution. And I think it definitely plays a role in, you know, how some people perceive and, you know, I'm careful in saying how we advance culturally, or, you know, how we advance within the educational kind of system. You know, I think of one of the greatest examples. I can't think of the name of the specific study, but it was a study done on African-American boys and ADHD, and how it presented and how it related to them in the education system. And from about the probably late 90s to the early 2000s, you had a multitude of African-American males being diagnosed with ADHD, and primarily just the basis of this diagnosis was coming from the education system. And it really wasn't, after, you know, kind of did longitudinal studies to kind of figure out, it really wasn't that these individuals had ADHD. It was more so the educational approach that they were given from their teachers. So, you know, how does that relate overall? Does cultural play a part in, you know, our educational experience? I believe so, but, you know, some people may or may not disagree.
Well, I think it's very interesting you bring up that point, because when we look at the different type of manners, if you will, that people do learn, and then we look at our education system here in America as far as secondary and primary education, when you have a teacher that's tasked with teaching, 20 to 30 students, does that teacher in their time span have enough time or have the ability to cater to the specific academic needs? As far as, I mean, do people generally learn? There are some people that just learn by reading. There are some people that learn by note taking, or people that learn as far as tactile type of methods is. So it just gets kind of difficult, if you will, for to focus. And it's kind of weird saying this, but to focus on the individual when, in the grand scheme of things, when you're looking at the whole institution in itself and the time that that we have to kind of get that information, like to educate the students. And I guess that's where the need for some sort of reform, if you will, needs to come about, because some people are relationship-oriented. Some students like to develop a relationship with their teacher, and that relationship causes the education to become that much more important, and for them to appreciate the information that's being provided. And then you also just have some people that just need for the information to become relevant to who they are and what it is that they want to do. Because sometimes, I know we've all had to learn something that we don't appreciate, you know, cough, cough, physics and things of the sort. But how do we get to a point to where for people that don't have the patience or that don't see the need for a specific education to value the grand scheme of things, as for whether, I mean, the terminal, whether that be a diploma or a degree or just or whatever the case may be, how do we look at that destination, the terminal goal, and cause that terminal goal to be our motivation to complete whatever it may be, if you will. So that's just...
I think it's a systematic kind of overhaul that needs to happen. It's funny because in looking on Facebook and Instagram and different things, I keep seeing these little memes, and they're funny, but they're kind of true as well, where it talks about individuals that have gone to college to get a degree, but then they need, like, 6 years of experience. So technically the degree that they went to get is invalid because they don't have enough experience. So they're kind of back to where they started. And, you know, to me what that says, like I said, even though it's comical, because I've been in those same situations where it's like, you know, I went to school, but then I'm told that I need 2 years of education. Well, I couldn't get 2 years of education because I was in school, so I don't know how this is supposed to work out. But I think it shows a society that necessarily doesn't really sometimes really value education. And we look at that, in the, you know, in the same sense, you know, it kind of is a catch-22, because in the, you know, on one hand, we have where they say you need experience, and then on another hand, you could very well walk into some jobs and positions and just merely off of the fact that you do have this piece of paper or you do have this degree, you are, you know, hired or at least considered. So, you know, I feel like on both ends it is a kind of difficult situation to tackle or to address.
Well, I'll say, if you recall, the caller from several shows ago, how he talked about education, and he said, you know, education isn't about necessarily going out and getting a job. It's not about that. Education is about bettering oneself, because there's a quote that kind of just opens the door and kind of just explains a lot, and it just really touches me, is that it's from Sidney Harris, and it says, "The whole purpose of education is to turn mirrors into windows." Just think about that. The purpose of education, turning mirrors into windows. It's deep. I mean, when you just think about it, that small amount of words, and we're looking at, because we focus so much on, and essentially sometimes on just self. But when we look at how we play a role in so much that goes on, and just getting out. And one of the best things about my academic experience was learning about others' lifestyles, upbringings. It was like, it was definitely a melting pot, and it just gave you a worldly experience. It causes you and challenges you to look at, and in some respects, just respect and appreciate other people's opinions, because there is nothing more amazing to me than someone who truly stands up for what they believe and what they feel. And when you sit back and you have a discussion with someone that may be totally opposite of what it is that you believe or you feel, and they're able to sincerely articulate what it is that they believe, I have so much more respect for that person, because they truly stand by what it is that they feel, and not just in an ignorant sort of, you know, mentality or mindset where it's just, you know, I just don't agree with you because of who you are. I just don't agree with that. But when you seriously challenge one another, and it causes you to learn from that person and just learn about what else exists, because you may think about and just experience things that you never thought before and look at things from a different perspective.
That's true. I agree with that notion. So in the scheme of things, because you kind of highlighted the topic, with education, and you noted that it was not necessarily about the curriculum-based idea of education, but more so about the idea of obtaining knowledge. So how do you personally value the education system or value, I know you said that you value your educational experience, so do you feel like it's fulfilled from that sense of that you got to learn different ideas and opinions and perspectives, or has it been fulfilled from the sense of, you know, you have or will attain a degree and you will be able to do X, Y, and Z?
You know, it's kind of both. Because I know in one, growing up, I used to always think, you know, why do we have to learn this and why do we do this and things. But I think that, you know, secondary and primary education, it's basically about building a platform and a foundation in order for you to go forward and thrive, and just giving you the minimal minimal, basically bringing you to kind of like some sort of main ground to be able to comprehend and understand ideas and just be able to relate to different people. And if you decide to go further with your education, it gives you the ability to become a part of that program. And I guess when you look at, you know, secondary education, why are you just talking about just secondary, or are you mean just in the total grand scheme of things as far as, like, collegiate?
Just in the total grand scheme of things.
Just in the grand scheme?
I mean, there are individuals. There's some people that never go to college. I know of individuals that, you know, as soon as they left school, they either went to the military or they possibly went to trade school. You know, they didn't necessarily go to a college or university. I know individuals that have gone on to get their associate's degree, so it's a varied kind of platform for, you know, the educational sense.
And I'm not saying that without education, or my personal feelings are that without education you can't be successful, but I think that, it, like I said, it aids you in just simply, and I hate using this word, but well, I'll tell you what, I'll use a different. I'm not going to say better, but I'm going to say empower oneself to become sort of a part of the greater idea of what's going on. And it gives you the ability to be marketable. If you decide that you want to go into some sort of arena or profession or whatnot in order to make that difference, or if you see problems with things, generally as far as being – quote-unquote respected with regards to your opinion, one must have experience or they must have education. We look at those people as being, you know, authorities, if you will, with regards to whatever the topic it may be. I don't think that an education in and of itself makes one as far as if you don't get an education, you're not going to be anybody. I wouldn't take it that far, but I value those that go to the middle. I just think that you must be some sort of productive entity in society, and that's very broad, if you will. But you should be contributive in one manner or another.
I definitely agree. And again, like, you know, you noted before, it depends on all in the perspective and where in. How you look at education, if you look at it from the sense of, is it the mastery of academics, or is education in the sense the mastery of self-skills and self-knowledge? So, you know, it definitely is, you know, based on your perspective of what education is.
And, well, I'm just sitting thinking. In any respects, I mean, do you think that the way that we're currently structured as far as education to a certain point being mandatory, do you think that that's relevant, or should there be some sort of, if there's a yearn or a want to learn?
I think
should we kind of focus?
I do believe in some sense that we should have certain elements or components of education. I just question the like what that looks like. And I say that in the sense of, you know, I can think of all the classes that I, you know, took in high school and college and even in grad school. And, of course, in, you know, grad school is a little bit different because it comes with the mastery of something. But even looking back on high school, I think about the different courses that I took. And not once, unless I'm playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, has somebody asked me about the Ottoman Empire or, you know.
Correct.
Or certain things, but there are certain skills that I probably could, it would have been nice to learn in school, like how to balance a checkbook, the purpose of taxes, how to do taxes. Those components of education, I think, or educating someone on those things, I think, should be required. Like life
and
skills.
And in some, right, in life skills, there are some, like we were, I was talking with a coworker once about they had to take like a home economics class. And because that was the only class that was left. And if you just look across, I think that, and I guess somewhat from our downfall, if you will, if you look at state by state, the academic institutions, they're so varied. There are some high schools where you can go and literally you work towards possibly an associate's degree while you're in high school throughout those last 2 years of schooling. If you decide that you want to go into the nursing field, you start working and becoming, you know, a nursing assistant, and then you work towards some sort of associate degree in nursing, and you just pretty much bridge into some sort of other college or university with regard. But they look at that more as a trade. It's just so varied as far as some academic systems in some states being so different than others. And some people they're learning just the minimal.
Some of those, I'm definitely a product of one of the things you mentioned. I attended a high school where I did health occupations. So upon graduating, I had my CNA, which was great because it made me marketable. So some of this experience that I had to have in order to do some other jobs or to advance later on in life, you know, I have definitely acquired while I was in school. So once I graduated, like I said, I already had my CNA. So addressing certain things or when I went to nursing school, it was a little more easier transition for me. But that's not the kind of roadmap for, you know, everybody. But I definitely agree that those programs, there should be more of them. And, you know, there should be more of a focus on how to fund them and to kind of get how to get people to participate in them. Like, I think of my class, like it was only like 6 people in the entire school that did the program at that particular time.
And not only that, but I think it's also important that we look at how do we get people to self-value, or not just self-value, but to value education. How do we motivate people to want to become a part and succeed with regard to education, to that terminal completion. It's for whether that may, I mean, even just in, let's just say just in high school, how do we call somebody to want to, because I'll tell you, and this is really, there was this man who was, he was the medical examiner for the county in which I grew up, Dr. Odell Owens, very inspirational man. He began his medical career as an embryologist, an in vitro fertilization specialist. And then he transitioned to become the coroner, believe it or not, for Hamilton County, Ohio. And one of the things that he said is that you either wear a cap and gown or you wear a body bag. The primary can come many times, as many as you choose, but the latter comes only once, and it's not by mistake.
That's deep.
And one of his main tenets of him working was to teach the living through the dead. And he taught me with just that one phrase. Because as I said last week, we have so many that yearn for success is usually, and it's sad, but when we talk to people, usually particular, and this is kind of stereotyping, but it's just from my experience of just talking with some people, you hear those, I mean, what do you want to do when you grow up type of things? Well, I want to be a basketball player. Well, I want to be a football player. And is it that we look at, or, you know, I want to rap, or I want to sing. We look at these people that make such grand amounts of money based on talent. Sometimes talent that's simply, I mean, that derived from birth and it's just intrinsic, and they just kind of hone in on it, you know, and tweak it and whatnot. But how do we get people to kind of get into those other sectors to where they can contribute in different manners?
I think it comes from just experience and, you know, involved, like the like being exposed to certain things. You know,
okay.
Like you had that experience with the coroner. There's some people that have never, you know, stepped outside of the city limits or stepped outside of their state to experience other things. You know, we learn a lot through our experiences and exposure to certain things.
And sometimes our environment, I think, it does prohibit us in essence from, because of oftentimes, and I think this is also important, is that we don't see people that look like us in positions of power or prestige. And I think that's important because sometimes that's not taught. I mean, when I just sit back and just think, there weren't very many even teachers that I saw that looked like me. I've never had a doctor that looks like me.
You know, I agree with that.
Until I got into adulthood.
I also say that in times where you don't see individuals that present like you or you don't see avenues, then, you know, you also have the capability. I believe we all have the ability to kind of create that path or create that avenue for, you know, others, you know. And mind you, that takes a lot of ambition and a lot of focus, but, you know, just because I didn't see it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen or it doesn't or will not happen. Sometimes you have to take the initiative to make those things happen.
Correct. But I think that with regards to those people, those are people that have that self-motivation to thrive and flourish and to go into those specific arenas. But I'm talking as far as those people that need some sort of motivation or that simply look out and all they see as far as, like, what's respected and what's I'll take this back. Let's take this back. At one point in time, I remember I was speaking with somebody, and they brought up the idea of different people groups and just people from different backgrounds. And I'll tell you that even in a slight kind of a different perspective, T.D. Jakes actually touched on it as well. But when you look at a $20 bill and its value, a lot of people know the value of that $20 bill, but it's based upon your circumstance and your environment per se. Sometimes the value of that instrument is either diminished or quantified. It's kind of difficult to elaborate on it because I just really feel that for some people, they need some sort of role model or some sort of model or models, if you will, that'll give them the ability or the motive or give them some sort of motivation to go forward, because a lot of people don't have the parental units that are aiding them in becoming successful and growing and giving them the ability to thrive. And when you look around and you don't see very many options, I don't know how we can get someone like that to become Because in those situations, I think that education would aid them in becoming, you know, as you look at, is education truly the great equalizer, or is it a false sense of success? And for some people, I don't think that it's a false sense of success, but I just think that it's not a realistic option for them. And I will also say for those that have never experienced college or the collegiate or university experience is totally different, in my opinion, than that of high school. You have the ability to, if you will, dibble and dabble in what truly is important to you, whether that may be Pan-African studies or if people decide that they want to, you know, specifically focus on social sciences or life sciences or, there are so many routes you can take to become marketable, if you will. It's changing with regards to once upon a time just the high school or diploma or just the GED being the ultimate marker of marketability.
I agree. And it is, you know, hard, but and sometimes it is just, you know, planting a seed, and it may not necessarily be something that presents itself, but, you know, like we kind of talked about or shed light on last week with the American dream, if it's something that you want and are, you know, just the peak of an interest of something, then, you know, most certainly there are things in society that, you know, can support you or, you know, will support you. I think a lot of it comes from, you know, like you said, it's in motivation senses, you know, individuals valuing themselves beyond what they currently are. And that takes a lot because that, again, that goes back to that self-work because now you're retraining individual psyche to believe in themselves and believe in the things that they're trying to acquire. And, you know, I don't think there's a person or a thing that can do that. I think that's intrinsic.
And I also want to just reiterate as I sit here and just reflect on what it is that I did say is that I don't really necessarily believe in any manner that education makes any other person better than anybody else, especially working in a career that is looked at as I guess somewhat being a trade, but you know, part of at one point in time there's this and still going on now. There's this push, if you will, to professionalize the law enforcement profession. There are many departments throughout the country now that are requiring education, if you will, and the only alternative to that is prior law enforcement experience or military experience. And an honorable discharge from the military. So with that being said, many people, if you will, kind of look at education and they look at it as something admirable. It's something that and I think that's what a lot of employers as well look at, is that when you sit there and you focus on a goal over the course of, you know, 4 to 6 years, because for many people around that collegiate age, they haven't done anything for that specific, that amount of time that's consistent, that's focused on, you know, it's kind of a building block type of thing. And with just that experience or just the academic experience, some people get work experience with that. You network in so many manners, and I think that's somewhat where our appreciation or some people's appreciation kind of falls is because of that time dedication that one must have in order to go forward, and they just want to get out into the world. And I've done it so many times that you just want to get out into the world and become part of the world. You want to work, you want to experience adulthood, but you just feel so confined with having to dedicate so much of your time and your life towards an education.
I agree. And it's funny because I think a lot of people think of college as an experience. And I do, too, in the sense of, you know, you get to do wonderful things. But like you said, and when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you're really not obtaining that kind of knowledge base of even what you're learning at this end, you know. And people can probably agree, like, when you start college, you go into these classrooms and there's 90-something people.
Right.
And you're learning about this topic that you're supposed to build you up to another topic, and it's just like, yeah, I can barely remember some of the things, you know, that I learned in class. It wasn't until as I advanced a little bit more in my college experience that I actually, you know, kind of started to really pick up on things. Well, lo and behold, that was junior and senior year. Well, you know, at this point, it's the expectation that I've learned enough to be, you know, to be a master or be somewhat be degreed in this subject area, when really I've only had about two years of knowledge in this area.
And I think that also is an issue, is that with the way that, when, for instance, when people begin their collegiate education, they'll wait, many people will wait, and they'll start as an undecided, and they'll wait until, you know, they're in their sophomore, you know, year to decide what it is that they want to, what degree program they want to take part in. And I think sometimes that can be a downfall, because if we're working towards, like, a lot of that experience that people are talking about, sometimes that can be gained, if you will, as far as, you know, volunteering or just shadowing, or a lot of people kind of, they value that with when you try to apply and market yourself to some sort of degree program, or not degree program, I'm sorry, but job after graduation, because they want to make sure that this isn't something that you're just jumping into, because sometimes it can be a shock due to, like, whether that be the level of responsibility or just the workload. They want to make sure that this is what you want to do, because and that's one thing that I learned totally, is that the academic perspective of criminology and law enforcement is totally different than the application. It's totally different, because you can sit back and you can talk about theory, and you can talk about, you know, what your views are with regard to those academic tenets, but once you look at the actual application in certain respects and you see those theories in play oftentimes and what you believe, sometimes it may cause it to shift, because things look different when they're on paper as far as when you go out into the real world. You can say, you know, so-and-so people this and that, but sometimes people's views, they truly do change once they see things truly in perspective and the application of it in the real world.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that could be said for any major that particularly relates or has some relation to any kind of human interaction. I can't tell you how many times, you know, even in I ended up switching my major in college to psychology and getting my master's in psychology, but I initially was a nursing major. And I could think of, like, all these scenarios with the perfect conditions in both majors where, you know, there were things where, you know, it was the perfect timing, the perfect resources were available, and then got out here in the real world of social work, and it's like, there's nothing, figure it out. So, you know, again, like you said, the application of those things, yeah, I have been able to apply some of those theories to how I relate to individuals, but most certainly the application in my experience is probably more so has shifted since I've actually applied
right.
it in my occupation.
And I just think that if a lot of those, because theories, and you can attest to this, a lot of those theories are, you know, tens and hundreds of years old, and when they don't account for, and sometimes they do, it's just different, that sometimes times change, and there are a lot of factors, or everything's not always, they're not constant. There's a lot of variables that play a role in the condition of something. when you look at those variables, and sometimes a lot of variables aren't accounted for, and sometimes at one point in time they weren't even in existence, if you will. I mean, it's just kind of a shock to kind of get out and see those differences that you weren't initially, but they initially weren't a part of your training. You're like, oh gosh, now how does this change the game? Or now what are my options? Or where do I go from here? And experience, like I said, it does help, and I think that's why it's valued so much in conjunction with education, but that experience only comes into play once we actually dedicate ourselves to something and become part of that idea, and you, when we play a role and dibble and dabble in it for just a small period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think an interesting thing is when you look at kind of our social constructs, education is one of those included. Like and it's funny that you said it or highlight, you mentioned it a little bit, but I think people do look at education as a status point, you know, when really technically, because of it's ever growing and evolving, and you should be continuously learning and experiencing different things. It really shouldn't, but for a good core of individuals, society-wise, I would say they still value education as a status point. You know, it makes a major play into who we date, who we marry, who our children hang around, who we allow in our social circles.
And I'm looking over this article that you share with me, and in so many respects, I'm just, I know this is going to really set off some tones for you, but where does socioeconomic status play with regard to the value and the excellence in education? Because it just seems that it plays such a great role, and if we're talking about somewhat really changing or shifting, if you will, the mentality or mindset, I mean, how do you simply change one's socioeconomic status without, it's kind of like which came first, the chicken or the egg. When you look at socioeconomic status and education is generally sometimes one of those main tenets or foundation points to change that status and affect that status. But when you're just, whether it be low income or poverty stricken, because what really just brought it to me is that it said 97% of low income students rely on school for internet access, which I mean, just that in of itself is just like, interesting, and with one regard, it just causes me to think about what is that relationship?
I think it's the same for lunch programs and stuff too. I think a lot, and I'm careful when even looking at different studies and stuff because people use cohorts that are not necessarily illustrate the all encompass all individuals. But they're just more
right.
Like a select individuals. But I think, like you said, it does. I don't know. I have a disclaimer because you're right. It does set off bells in me because I do believe that it does start with the kind of socioeconomic status, because it is hard to say I want someone to believe in something and be something bigger than they are when they don't have access to the necessary resources. And, you know, agree, I'm all for ambition and making things happen, but then there's just some time when you still need resources and you need help. And most of the time what we see, unfortunately, in a lot of our education system is when you look at some of these areas that are considered low income and poverty, you look at their test scores and you look at the mm-hmm. education system and the resources that they have, and they're parallel to each other. So I guess more so, it, you know, who's to blame then? Because it's not necessarily these individuals that are not striving for excellence. It's more so they haven't been given the opportunity or the resources to even do so.
Interesting. And I don't know how we move forward from that, because you can look at personal success and how you move forward, and someone that in the same circumstances as you experience the same things, and you look at why they didn't make it or why they went a different route and you did when you were given the same opportunities. But I, like I said, there are many variables that play a role. There are many variables, and sometimes you just can't. Everything doesn't just go according to the plan or where they how they should go. If you look at, you know, well, 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. Well, in real life, it doesn't always go that way, because you never know if that first one is going to have something else attached to it or if the second one is going to be diminished by one factor or another. And that's what just causes me to kind of think and just really, really ponder on how do we cause people to value something that historically they just haven't. And even with the quote-unquote promise of becoming more empowered or becoming more marketable, because of that, some people want to escape their circumstances now. They want to experience life from a different perspective. And we talk about education being one of the greatest equalizers, and I truly believe it is, because it does change the way you look at things, but I also think that experience does too. Because I work alongside a lot of people that truly have different and varied views of things, but we're still able to work on one accord and relate to one another, and we don't hate one another simply because of what it is and the differences that we have with regard to belief. And I think that education gives you that ability. It really does, because you begin to look at things, and sometimes, well, I remember one thing that really made it difficult for me was they would bring up a topic, and then you automatically have your belief, but now you're charged with the task of fighting your belief with some sort of other perspective. And it's really difficult. Because you know how it is that you feel about the specific topic or whatever it is that you're talking about, but now you have to fight that, and you have to be on the contrary or one of the other contraries, and then you just go back and forth. And at one point, we did that with a group of people, and there were different people that held a different perspective or opinion for the purposes of the discussion. And you kind of learn that there are always going to be other perspectives, and you some sort of just, if you can't find a common ground, then you respect it for what it is and you just move forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree. I think education is the varied, it is the melting pot of varied ideas and opinions. And without that, you know, to me, that's the greatest sense of ignorance, more than it is you not having a degree or not going to school. It's more so that you don't have the opportunity, nor are you open to the idea of various perspectives that differ from your own.
And also what's shocking is that when you start talking about higher education, a lot of the people that aren't taking part in higher education are, I mean, people talk about due to money and due to the financial aspect. And you just look at how many programs and things are out there to aid those people to get. But it goes back to that value and just the importance of what it is. I mean, you can't just say that people should do this, people should do that, because you don't know their struggle, and you don't know oftentimes how they derive their specific views. And I think the saddening part is just, go ahead.
No, I just think, like you said, that, you know, even in the sense of the value, especially when it comes to higher education, as much as I want to say that there, you know, there's people that value and just don't take a part of the advantages and programs, I will full-fledged, I will not turn a blind eye that there is an economic problem with obtaining higher education in the United States of America. The amount that it costs to go to school, the amount of student loans that people have to acquire is ridiculous for folks that actively want to pursue that. And, yes, there are programs, but a lot of those programs have caveats and, you know, things, you know, circumstances that are not applicable to each and every person. But overall, systematically, there is a problem, and there continues to be a problem with the cost of education, let me say, in regards to higher education in the United States of America.
I agree. I do, because I think that it is. I mean, even if you just look at the cost, the differences in cost for in-state versus out-of-state tuition in a lot of respects, and I know even if you look at sometimes a lot of these people, and I guess people would say, well, you know, taxes may play a role because you're in-state, your taxes go and aid the academic, you know, institution for that state. But what if we're talking about, you know, this 18 or 19-year-old that has never worked, has never held a job, you know, how is that great cost differentiation justice? I guess their parents, I guess that would also aid them. But it's just so strange how literally sometimes it's almost doubled if you look at in-state tuition versus out-of-state tuition. And the different endowments that a lot of these academic institutions in many states have, it's just, it's incredible if you look at the money that goes along with, you know, paying for an education. So I do agree with you there.
I think tuition, and it continues to go up, and that's kind of like the crazy thing. Like, I look at the cost of tuition from when I was an undergrad, Laura, I'm about to tell my age, 10 years ago, comparison to what it is now. And it's like it's more than quadrupled. You know, I remember attending, I'm not going to say my university, but and as an in-state student for per semester, I think it was like $1,500, where in comparison now at same university, mind you, it's gotten bigger and, you know, greater and things, but I think it's about $5,000 or $6,000, don't quote me on that, but that's a vast difference for pretty much the same education, the same opportunity, because when we both complete, we'll have the same name on the degree and everything. And that's a lot, because job markets aren't, you know, necessarily changing for those who aren't educated. So how are students, you know, supposed to be able to fund the opportunity to even attend these? Grants haven't increased.
Right. I guess it's just a question that I'm not able to answer. It just really causes me to really just sit back and think that, I mean, it's a sacrifice of being tied into so much financial obligations to pay for college worth. Is it worth it? And for some people, it's just more easy. It's easy to just take different routes. But what concerns me is that the amount of jobs that are there that gives some sort of promising retirement or some sort of, you know, future security with regards to working and age, and when we start getting into politics and talking about, you know, the security and the future of things like, you know, Social Security and whatnot, is that going to be there when, you know, someone at the age of 20 and 30 now retires? And, or, I mean, a lot of professions are doing away with pensions, and they're striving towards 401(k)s and other type of things. So when we talk about, you know, education with regard to that, you know, versus the amount of jobs that are there that are providing some sort of retirement or future security for people, that's just what concerns me, because I want people to be able to work towards something, as opposed to simply just focusing on today and tomorrow, and because eventually, I mean, what are you going to do when you're not able to fight the same battle today that you or tomorrow that you did today? Eventually, at one point in time, that time is going to come. And it's just kind of saddening because they really, a lot of people just really have nothing to look forward to.
That's true. And
especially with what I do, I just sit back every day. And when I work, I see people, I'll tell you, there was a gentleman, he was 79 years old, and he was a construction worker. He had came to Kentucky from Virginia. I forget the name of the town. Charleston, Virginia is a town. He's from Charleston, Virginia, and he was working. He was contracted by our Metropolitan Sewer District to build these vast reservoirs for solid waste. And we're talking about, you know, football fields long that are, you know, 15, 20 feet within the ground, and he's pumping concrete. Pretty intensive pretty intense with regard to labor. But this man was 79 years old.
Oh my God.
And I'm sure that there's retirement, there's things there, but it elicited so much because when you talk about people that work and they work and they work and that's all they focus on and they're at that work ethic is there versus, I mean, I know there are some factors, but, and even in this country, when you look at sometimes a different, in some respect, it's quote unquote easier, if you will, to not work and be provided with resources.
Boy, you done brought up
as opposed right, as opposed to the people, I mean, you have some people out here that are seriously nickel and dime and really working and they're struggling. And sometimes you have to think, is it better for me just to, you know, to not work and there be resources there that aid me in simply living, or should I make that sacrifice and, you know, struggle to get what I want and try to strive towards some of the things, or get the things that I need to try to strive towards some of the things that I want.
It's just crazy that you say that, because I just thought about that the other day, and it really is hard, and I think it's hard for folks in my age group too, because I don't think there'll be like a social security system by the time that I reach age of the maturity age to actually receive it. So really to allow or to continue, for me, fortunately, the program that I work in, right, because I work for the government right now, they kind of require you to participate in the retirement plan. But, you know, in a year when I don't have to and it's kind of by choice, if I want to continue putting it towards it, that's going to be a real hard decision for me, because it's like knowing, like, do I want my cake now? Because I don't think my cake's going to be there, you know, 20, 30 years from now. So in the same sense, you know, it's kind of hard for me to even encourage others to, like, well, why get more education, or why go back to school? Why value education, period, when, like you said, at the end of the tunnel, there necessarily isn't anything for you. But hearing stories like what you just said, because I do not, I cannot be out here 79 doing social work. Just is not going to happen.
And so, I don't know, what his reasoning was behind that. I know he went back every week. He said he left on either Thursday evening or Friday morning or something of the sort. He went back to his family and stayed there until Saturday night or something of the sort, just to be with them. And, you know, but when I compare that to just so many people that I don't know if they look at that perspective, or if it's more focused on now. It's that instantaneous gratification to want things now. You know, it's basically a microwave society. It's a microwave mindset. And that's really all you are pretty much focused on. And how do we shift that? Because I think that that's the mindset, if you will, is part of the reason why I think a lot of people don't look at education in certain ways compared to others.
I agree. It definitely is a
big
and
I don't know
topic.
How. It definitely is. It really is. And stemming from that, I know this is off topic slightly, but I want to get your perspective and maybe some of the listeners are kind of, I don't know, they're kind of, you know, kind of interesting, if you would, as well. But this is a work story that I want to get your expertise on as far as mental health goes. And I'll tell you this. Over the course of my career, a small career, I mean, it's only been 3 years since I've started, I deal with a lot of people that are affected by mental illness. And a lot of people within our jurisdiction are affected by mental illness in great proportions, to the point to where our department has started what we call a crisis intervention team, and we refer to it as CIT. And it's, it gives officers the ability to utilize certain training to respond and be able to interact, quote-unquote, appropriately with those that are affected by different types of mental illness, whether it be PTSD or bipolar. Generally, it's bipolar, schizophrenia, and those type of things. And what interests me is that when you deal with people that have murdered people and been convicted of homicide or murder, that suffer from these mental illnesses, and when you deal with people that have been charged with certain very violent crimes, such as, you know, murder and things of the sorts, and those people that are incompetent to stand trial, how do we? What interests me is that these people are put right back into society. Well, and I can't speak in the great, the general. I'm talking about specifically related to just where, you know, my jurisdiction. But I know it happens all throughout the country. But when you look at somebody, and it's very interesting, that somebody that has killed a person and that they're incompetent to stand trial because of their mental illness, and as opposed, generally you would think that a person would be placed in some sort of psychiatric facility to get them to where they need to be in order to be able to function, in a manner which is more comparable to that of the masses. I know there's always going to be some challenges, and there's going to need to be, you know, ongoing therapy and things of the sort. But that, and I immediately thought about you because it was, you know, I said, wow, you know, we're talking about somebody that's incapable, incompetent, quote unquote. And I don't, and I'm pretty sure you know how difficult it is to truly be incompetent, and for to be found incompetent, to have, you know, the quote unquote mens rea, if you will, to commit some sort of crime. So I mean, what are your, and I think that slightly plays a role because, you know, with regards to how we were talking about ADHD and the labeling and diagnoses of people, and I think it starts early. But this is just in the grand scheme of things. These are people that are consistently out here victimizing people, and there's not very many resources that I believe that from at my disposal that are in place to aid these people from ceasing that type of behavior. Because with that, I also think that times are somewhat changing because there was at one point, if you will, where people, from my limit, you know, or just relation to people, coping mechanisms have changed and shifted, and what we would once deal with, if you will, because with those coping mechanisms, now it causes the person to be labeled or diagnosed, and they have to go further and, you know, there would be medication or some sort of lifelong or ongoing treatment plan. So what, I mean, what are you, I know it's kind of like a double-edged type of issue, but I just want to get, like, your expertise.
I think it is, you know, and I always tell people, you know, labels like schizophrenic and bipolar are just that, they're labels. But, you know, very essentially at the core of individuals, you know, you could, you know, there's bad people in the world, number one, and those people may or may not have a mental illness, and it doesn't integrate into each other. But most certainly it is a complex system as it relates to mental health and the law and ability to deem someone incompetent, because it's in the same sense of when individuals that you know, I've dealt with cases where I've known individuals are definitely a risk to themselves, and maybe not necessarily a risk to society, but they're a risk to themselves, and trying to deem them incompetent to essentially, in my opinion, save their lives and having to go to the various channels of the law to do that. In regards to individuals committing crimes, I definitely think it is an accountability sense. A good forensic psychologist or whoever's completing that kind of competency evaluation definitely is going to consider all that components. Unfortunately, the way that the system works is a lot of times you don't get that necessarily time to do some of that background or that kind of diagnostic or functional piece of the evaluation that it really takes to kind of deem that. You know, you're kind of thrown this case and said, here, figure out if they're incompetent or not based off of these evaluations and probably meeting the person one time. So
right.
You're making this, you know, making this fundamental decision that essentially can carry on for the duration of this person's kind of, you know, life. And it is, you know, it is a lot. But again, like I said, I think it's a twofold kind of working together thing. I think definitely as clinicians from the mental health piece, there is a certain amount of accountability that we have to charge our consumers or our individuals that we provide services to. You know, just because you have a mental illness, developmental or intellectual disability or whatever it shall be, doesn't necessarily mean that you are not accountable for your actions. I'm a firm believer in that. Like, anybody that's ever worked with me or, for, you know, or around me will say that. Like, I hold people accountable for their actions because I still do believe, you know, especially if I'm providing the necessary resources and tools to you, that means you are accountable in some sense to what happens. But definitely from the sense of the law, I think it just needs to the laws have to change in regards to mental health. And, you know, I can only hope they change for the better, you know, even in reading some of the language that is used in law code or different state codes, and it's just like, yeah, like this is not even relevant to what we're dealing with now, you know, because they, like you said, they mention things that are not even existing. You know, one of the things about Virginia and North Carolina and some of the places that I've worked is, you know, they had the option of institutions. Well, you know, we passed all these great laws and things that no longer where institutions, A, no longer exist, or they are slowly but surely, you know, going away. So in that sense, if we don't have an institution, where are we providing these individuals these services?
Uh-huh.
Because there is a such thing as the criminally insane. So if there's no institution to put them in, then technically this person is deemed capable of going back in society? Is it the jail's problem? Is it the local behavioral health authorities issue? You know, who is to solve this? But, you know, a lot of times we as providers, and I can only speak from my current position, we're mandated to do things that are not even within our resources to do so. So I definitely think it's a twofold kind of thing. But, like I said, more importantly, I think people should and need to be held accountable from the sense in which they can comprehend.
Correct. And my great concern is that I deal with so many people that have been legally held incompetent to stand trial, which means that at that point, they're no longer able to go through a criminal adjudication or a process to even become incarcerated in some sort of correctional facility. And they're essentially, I mean, basically found not guilty. Or, I mean, they're not even not guilty. It's just not even the initial steps aren't even, you can't even implement those. So these people are just basically put back into society to continue victimizing people. And the sad part about it is if, you know, once somebody becomes a victim, whether that may be some sort of assault, because, you know, and I'll also say that sometimes that mental illness causes these people to become, the people that we're talking about, to become homeless because they can't provide those necessary entities to themselves or relate in a manner which provides them, you know, housing and things of the sort. So, I mean, it's just a great concern of mine, and I'm always there trying to find those resources in order to better the quality of life for all of the people that I provide police services to. And sometimes it becomes very difficult because, as you said, your hands do become tied. But I think that, you know, you do have a great, great sense of responsibility and a moral obligation to help and to do all that you can. And sometimes it's just that ability is just not there, and you just continue to keep fighting, and at some point your resources are just exhausted. So you're just fighting with nothing. You're just down to your hands just trying to move forward, and it becomes very frustrating because I tell you, I sincerely get tired of, you know, the senseless and the unneeded criminal activity that takes place.
And, you know, and in the same sense, you know, there's a varied of, you know, social workers and therapists and psychologists and things that, you know, also reach their peak of exhaustion because, like I said, the law can work for you or it can work against you. And in the same sense of, you know, just as hard as we work to ensure, you know, individuals don't go to jail and other things, that it may, you know, we're often perceived as doing, is sometimes we work to make sure that our individuals get the necessary treatment, even if that means, you know, temporarily detaining that individual or in Virginia we call it ECOs, or emergency custody orders, where they're, you know,
correct,
sent to ordered pretty much for treatment. And that is it's a very difficult process at times. When, like you said, you know, a lot of times the resources aren't there or necessarily becomes like a revolving door. But, you know, morally we still have that obligation to, you know, every day is a new day, you know. And, you know,
now,
no matter
how many
times,
do those ECOs, are those limited to the 72-hour psychiatric hold, or those, and do you mean post that 72 hours, sort of commitment?
The ECOs are the 72 hours hold, and then they have a special hearing in which is determined if they will go, well, pretty much the duration of their treatment. Now, what I see happens a lot of times, no shade to Virginia, is, you know, a person may voluntarily go in and say, yeah, I want to go in for service. Well, then the societal issues come in because then we have bed crowding, and then you have an individual that doesn't have insurance.
Uh-huh.
Well, magically,
uh-huh,
within 2 days, Jimmy Bob, who was once stabbing someone, is now competent enough and treated enough that they now can be deemed, you know, back into society. So it all comes where we all have to work together. Now, what I can say is, definitely with the influence of CIP and having worked with officers, I do see the kind of bond, the kind of flow of systems working between the police, at least for my area, working with the police department and working with the mental health agency that I work for. We rely on our officers, and our officers rely on us. We have a very good dynamic, at least in that sense, I will say.
Well, I'm there with you, and I you know, in comparison to Virginia, we're right there with you with regard to, I mean, there are essentially people out here that we involuntarily commit that are great threats to society, that have been threats in those senses to law enforcement. I mean, I can't tell you how many people that have become agitated for whatever reasons. I mean, whether that may be usually it's some sort of intoxicant that we generally don't know, but it's kind of important to get those people the necessary aid that they need immediately so they're not further compromised medically. But those people that are very aggressive are generally out, like, you know, within several hours. And that's where the concern to me becomes, because I think that's a great problem, because, I mean, your whole purpose is to preserve, or at least my purpose is to preserve the preservation of life and property. And it just bothers me that the mental illness, or the response to mental illness, those type of, we call it EPS, emergency psychiatric services, that we utilize within one of our major trauma hospitals. I don't know if there's and I hate to say this, but like an over usage, if you will. I mean, because as you said, people that say, you know, I need help, I'm hearing voices, I'm suicidal, you know, so-and-so, or, you know, is telling me, the wall's telling me to go kill so-and-so. I mean, these are things that people are generally like, oh, gosh. But these are things that we deal with in a consistent basis, and those people are rendered, you know, not a threat to themselves or others, and just put right back out. And sometimes we have consistent consumers that we're dealing with weekly, or sometimes daily, and that's of great concern. So that's why I bring that up, but it just really bothered me having to sort of, you know, deal with certain individuals that are ultimately nothing's going to happen to them because they've been found and labeled to be incompetent within the legal system. And that's you can be incompetent, you know, in sort of like, you know, as far as mental illness goes, and, you know, be depressed or whatever the case may be, but that doesn't mean that with regards to the law, you aren't incompetent. It's a great standard, and once that standard is met, it's going to be quite difficult to
And you know what? I would love to divulge in that a little bit, like, later, of course, but divulge in that more, because that is a difference in interpretation of competency, because a person criminally stealing credit cards is different from a person that is having a psychotic episode and has yielded a weapon. There's two different things going on. A person with an intellectual disability possibly doing something or acting aggressively is differently from, like I said, a person that is intoxicated and high on cocaine and now decided to rob a liquor store or whatever it may be. Those are terrible examples, but but there is a difference in how we look at, or at least how most clinicians will look at how a person is deemed competent. And like you said, I'm interested to hear how that varies in regards to the law as well.
Well, I'm definitely here to help you, because, I mean, daily we deal with those type of situations. I'm sure you do as well. But and then even under the law, intoxication isn't a justification for criminal activity, and it doesn't negate the mens rea or the mental aspect of, you know, you committing the crime. So I think that's definitely a future topic that we can dabble in, because I think that's going to be quite. It would interest me in the very least, to be able to see, you know, how things work on your end, because, I mean, maybe it will, because I know it's going to be different and vary from your area as far as Virginia to here, but it's just always been an ongoing battle here, because with the different changes in society, different professions are charged with additional duties that were at one point in time not a concern of theirs. And I really truly feel that over the course of time, I've pretty much developed into a social worker, and that's become part of my duties. I mean, it gets you're my main, and the reason why I say that is my goal, and many times, or my responsibility, is to provide resources that are at my disposal to those whom are in need. And in sometimes those are obligations that are handed down from administration, and they're no longer, you know, at one point in time it used to be if there was a legal response or some sort of legal responsibility, if there was an arrest or some sort of enforcement that needed to be made, then you would do it. But that's no longer in play. And there are sometimes, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many times I respond to people's homes because their children don't want to go to school. Or and you're thinking, oh, wow, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to step in as a law professional and become someone's parent. You know, what do they expect me to use force? Do they expect me to arrest this juvenile because they don't want to go to school? Am I supposed to educate a parent on how to be a parent? I mean, there's so many. It's just really changed on the things that you respond to and how you, not only the calls that you respond to, but how you respond to those specific calls as far as handling them. And I know all this is truly off topic of our topic of education, but it's enlightening to kind of, you know, talk about that great relationship that's there. And just over the course of, I would say maybe the past, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, I think that that relationship has kind of forged, and there's been a need for it because you're starting to talk about a lot of those people that are becoming a part of the criminal element due to mental illness. And I think that's why there are, at one point in time, there wasn't a known method for, you know, law enforcement professionals to respond to those people, and you treat them. And sometimes you have to treat people, you know, differently. You talk to them differently. And
absolutely.
They're different.
We have a mental health court, and it's fairly new. Well, not fairly new. You would think it would be something that has existed for a while, but it actually is a fairly new kind of concept on even legally how you deal with individuals that, you know, have mental illness, because it is a different concept. And if we look at it from the interpretation of the law now, it probably would be more punitive. Not to say at times it doesn't, but and sometimes it doesn't. It just depends on the individual and the situation.
It does, and I think that it's even with that, I think it needs to be reevaluated because it's becoming such a constant issue that we're dealing with. And like I said, the main thing that just bothers me is, like I said, I just hate to see people victimized, and I believe that some people can be rehabilitated, but I also believe that there are people out there that are going to, you know, manipulate that sort of mindset, and some people simply need to be punished. You know, I mean, when people do things wrong, they need to be punished. You know, when you look at a child that does something that they themselves know they shouldn't have done, you don't focus on simply rehabilitating it. You punish because they know they shouldn't have done it in the first place. So if there's some sort of, you know, consequence to it, then hopefully we would think that they wouldn't do it again. But you can't do that. That's not a finite type of response to all instances of criminal delinquency. So that's why I think there really needs to be an ongoing evaluation and discussion, because mental illness is a real thing, that exist. But we just also have to look at a lot of the facets on why that mental illness is, you know, in place. And I mean, is it something that person can cope with, but they're choosing not to for whatever reason, or there's an inability to cope with it, or are they not fulfilling their responsibilities? I know that one thing that brought forth is one of my partners said, you know, if you get back, quote unquote, sane or on your medication, your regimen, why would someone want to not continue taking that medication and be the person that they are?
Oh, and I said, you know, that is a deep topic.
I know. And I said, you know, I mean, there's a lot that goes with it. There really is a lot that goes with it. I mean, you just, but it starts the discussion, and it gives us the ability to put those perspectives on the table and just talk about and educate one another on what it is that, you know, the other party deals with, and how both of our responsibilities pretty much mesh into one, and how we can get the people the true help or punishment that they so greatly deserve. We have to throw that caveat in there because there are some people that, I mean, it's just the way it is. And that's just my perspective. You know, I know that, you know, it's real and it's something that we have to deal with. And if we're going to have to deal with it, I think we should know how to deal with it as opposed to just, you know, dealing with it on a type of impromptu status.
Absolutely. Well, as always, it has been lovely. I think we just vary off on so many topics. We just, at least it rolls into what we're going to talk about next. So.
We do, but, you know, it's that's what it's all about. It's talking about, you know, real people talking about real issues and just giving perspective and trying to plant those seeds out there for people to, you know, who knows.
Absolutely.
So, next week, same time.
Same time, we'll, next week.
Yeah, we'll be here, and we'll go forward, and we'll do great things.
Absolutely.
Any closing, anything that you got or anything like that?
Nope, just continue to be great. Good luck to you.
All righty, guys.
Going
yeah, I know. Trying. Good luck to you as well. Hopefully we get some new exciting things to discuss next week. And yeah, that's about it. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Real Talk Radio with Brucey and Shakira. And we definitely appreciate everyone and their patronage. So until next time.
Take care.